FoundationsForTheArts.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Does President Trump have the power to take money from disaster relief and the military and put it toward construction of a partial wall on the southern border? We're going to talk with a constitutional law expert in a moment about that question. And the Green New Deal is in the news. We'll find out what it is. But first, five listener comments about yesterday's program, on which we discussed the shutdown of the government over the issue of building more of a wall along the southern border. Here's what several listeners had to say.
Yes, in reference of the commentaries on your program, by the way, which is really good. I love it. I like to listen every time I'm driving. On the border and the hysteria there is on the immigrants that are coming in, but nobody talks about the intervention of the United States on Central and South America for 100 years, starting with the Monroe Doctrine. Trump saying that how many lives we have to lose in blood of the American people and how many blood we have spilled in Central and South America. 40,000 people we kill in Honduras to change regimes, Chile, Argentina, Mexico, and we have military bases in all of them. So if these people fleeing because of the critical situation we created south of the border, why not do a restoration and help these people to come in and the need of the problem we have created in Central South America? That's my point. And as immigrant, they're talking about taking the jobs from the people in the United States. As an immigrant, I'm from Mexico. I come over here, I create my own business, and I hire people. And a lot of people, they are like me, they're entrepreneurs. They come up here to succeed and have a good life and good families. And we don't take in jobs from anybody. If they in the industry, on the cooking, there's Mexican working because they're so good cooks. And we have an excellent food. So they need us.
Hi, Rob, traveling nurse here. I was listening to the show today. It's a tough call. I am not under 40. I'm out here in the world every day. And as a white female, I do encounter discrimination from people of color because I don't speak Spanish or I'm not Spanish. I've encountered it recently. And it's really rather annoying to me. I don't like it. There is a lot of reverse prejudice out there in reference to your last caller. I am not a Trump supporter. Never have been, never will be. He is the worst possible thing that could have happened or is happening to this country. That's the nicest thing I can say on air about it. However, as far as immigration, we got to take care of our own backyard. We got people here going without food, going without medications. Why do I know this? Because I see it every single day. It's what I do for a living. And it definitely needs to be overhauled. I'm not against people wanting a better life, but until we start taking care of our own country and cleaning up our own backyard, how do you fix the problem?
Bill from Bradenton here. I just wanted to comment on today's show. I turned it on near the end, a few minutes before 12, and I heard Rob talking to somebody about the wall. Some people think the situation is scary, and I agree, but not for the reason that most people think. I heard Rob making all these really rational, calm, sensible comments to the caller about how the numbers were down, they spent billions on patrolling the border, it's not an open border. But this guy was like a dog with a bone who wouldn't let go. He kept repeating this stuff about, we don't want open borders. Nobody wants open borders. The Republicans don't want open borders. The Democrats don't want open borders. But he wouldn't let it go. And that's the scary thing. These people, you have to start to wonder, do they hear what's being explained to them? Or are they really just stupid? I mean, I don't like calling people stupid, but you have to start asking the question. And then straight after that, the news came on, and you hear Trump saying, we've got to have the wall, and it will pay for itself every few months. And these people hear that, and they believe it. I mean, totally unsubstantiated nonsense. That's the scary thing.
My name is Jack. About Trump's promises about the border wall, He makes a lot of promises that he never even mentioned afterwards. And the promise to keep our health coverage for everybody. And this is his words, not mine.
Calling about today's show at 11 o'clock. And in my humble opinion, I believe the problem and the real issue is rich versus poor.
Well, there you have some listener comments that came in after yesterday's program. When she campaigned for office last year, New York Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez called for the creation of a Green New Deal to deal with climate change, infrastructure, and creating middle-class jobs here in the U.S. The new House Speaker in Congress, Nancy Pelosi, did create a committee to study climate change, but it's not exactly what progressives wanted. Speaker Pelosi announced it 2 weeks ago that the committee to be named the House Select Committee on Climate Crisis will be chaired by Tampa's Democratic Congresswoman Kathy Castor. In a statement, Castor promised the new panel will reflect the urgency to reduce carbon pollution and will emphasize the creation of clean energy jobs. But the panel isn't expected to have some of the powers demanded by progressives, such as subpoena power or legislative authority, meaning it cannot pass bills to the floor for a full House vote. Castor also refused to mandate that all committee members reject political contributions from fossil fuel companies, saying it would violate the First Amendment. What is the Green New Deal? We're joined now by Greg Carlock. Greg is a Washington-based researcher in climate action policy and data and a senior advisor to Data for Progress. He's the lead author on a study called A Green New Deal, and he's on the phone with us live. Greg, welcome to WMNF. Nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
So what would the Green New Deal do?
I mean, I think that you mentioned, it really is about acknowledging and addressing the climate crisis as a core tenet. But doing that through a massive economic mobilization, similar to the FDR era New Deal to deal with the Great Depression. It's tired of small incremental changes to address a problem that is only becoming more and more worse around the country as more Americans see the climate impacts around hurricanes and wildfires, but also recognizing that the environmental problems are not independent of the other economic problems and income inequality and environmental justice problems. So it's trying to elevate all of those in the agenda for Congress to deal with.
What would be some of the parts of the Green New Deal? Talk about some of the programs that you advocate in your study.
Absolutely. Energy is absolutely a big piece. We've been talking about fossil fuels and coal and natural gas for a long time, and renewable energy has been growing and becoming cheaper and cheaper and is really now quite competitive. And we have to recognize that addressing climate change really means taking the carbon out of our energy. That's not only through renewable energy, but also energy efficiency that makes utility bills cheaper for everybody, and then also transportation and getting off of gasoline and these internal combustion engines. But it's getting away from the energy, which tends to take up a lot of the conversation. We also want to look at the guaranteeing the right of clean air and clean water in this country is incomplete, and there's a lot of work that can be done. You can use Flint as one example, but there's hundreds of communities across the thousands of communities that still rely on heavy lead infrastructure, and we have to deal with that. There's asthma and other pollutants in a lot of these communities associated with the fuels and the coal that we burn, and we have to address that. There's also our landscape. There's restoring forests and wetlands that not only provide for communities, help deal with carbon emissions, but also protect communities from storm surge and sea level rise and contribute to their economy through certain parts of agriculture and harvesting crawfish and stuff like that. There's a lot of southern economies built on wetlands. And then the last piece is about resilience. It really is about looking at where people live, local, rural, urban communities, and how climate's going to impact them, and making the necessary investments to make them more resilient. That's kind of the policy piece. The other two pieces are recognizing this is a job creator. It is a stimulus. It is going to move money to communities to create new jobs by definition. in a transformation like this. And then it has to be grounded in the environmental justice standards and job quality standards to make sure that it's addressing the inequities we've faced before. Targeting low-income, minority, and vulnerable communities that have been left behind, but also redefining the definition of a quality job.
Well, we're talking with Greg Carlock. He's a Washington-based researcher with a group called Data for Progress. He's the lead author of a study called Green New Deal. Did Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez, did she use your study, or was she directly involved in advocating for your study?
So she wasn't involved, if you're also familiar with the Sunrise Movement that's been doing a great job getting attention to this issue in Washington, D.C., they were not involved in the drafting of the report. Have they read it? I hope so. I think they have. You know, we stay in touch with the Sunrise Movement just to kind of coordinate on their activities, but, you know, we're not involved on a practical sense. But there are some differences. You know, if you look at the committee resolution that Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez put out for the Select Committee on a Green New Deal, it had some different targets. It had a lot of overlap. And then we touched on a lot of more topic areas than they did. But I think there's a lot of complementarity. And I think the conversation really should be about, you know, what are the goals? What are we trying to achieve? And try to get the American people to understand those goals.
Are you advocating retrofitting houses and putting solar on more houses and commercial buildings?
I would say absolutely. I think if you try to envision what a future would look like, I don't think it'll look terribly different in some regards to some of the lifestyles that Americans have today. But retrofitting homes is as much about cost savings and energy efficiency as it is about carbon reductions and air pollution. And that's really important to a lot of communities, particularly low-income communities, who a large share of their money, their paycheck, goes towards energy and water usage. And so efficiency matters. And then on the electricity, on the energy side, we need to distribute where we generate our energy and try to localize and democratize as much of that as we can. So whether that's through putting solar panels on commercial buildings, on residential buildings, and having these small microgrids around where communities are generating their own power, that makes them more resilient, that makes it cheaper for them, it makes the air cleaner, and that, I think, is a vision of what the future will be.
Mm. And I take it you would take lead pipes out of everywhere. If there's any lead pipes still leaching lead into the drinking water, you would get those out.
I think that should be a priority investment. Looking at what happened in Flint, and I think that there's a lot of other communities who face a similar aging infrastructure. And I don't think people realize how much we have buried under the ground all over this country. There's a lot of it, and whether that's currently in operation or it's just sitting there, it's been decommissioned, but it's just sitting there leaching into the ground. I think given the risks that these pose and how dangerous lead can really be, we would have to find and replace these things. On the order of cost to society on what toxins do, I think that'd be a good investment.
And the other thing that you mentioned a moment ago, you would try to reforest as much of the U.S. as possible, planting trees?
Yeah, I mean, looking at the legacy of some of the, you know, the FDR New Deal, the Conservation Corps did a lot of replanting, and that had to do a lot with the resource exploitation that happened in the industrial area, and then a lot of the, you know, the Dust Bowl, and we were losing soil, and we really needed to replant a lot of that. And in this spirit is recognizing that we have lost a lot of our historical forests. And forests are what we call a carbon sink, where they capture carbon and they hold it for a really long time. And, you know, we're down around 50% of historical forests in many parts. And it would be an important priority to reforest as much as we can. That's good for water, that's good for biodiversity, it's good for pollution, it's good for recreation and business.
Now, some of the jobs that you would be aiming at would be like solar installation and plumbers and carpenters and electricians. Those would be kind of middle-class jobs or not high-end middle class, but kind of medium middle class jobs, right?
Absolutely. And we are working on a new piece to try to flesh out the breadth of jobs that can be touched by a lot of these kinds of programs and industries that would benefit from this. And so it is in the trade skills. It is in the construction and manufacturing. It is in waste and energy, renewable energy. It's in energy efficiency and plumbers and electricians and all of those. And so we shouldn't view those as, you know, low-skill, low-income jobs. These will be skilled. Some of these require skill, and that's why we need workforce training, and we need workforce development and job training to help support these industries. And then make sure, as I said, through the job standards, that these are livable wage jobs. These are family-supporting wage types of jobs, and allow for unionization if that's the case. But we want to redefine what a good job is through programs like these.
Our guest is Greg Carlock. He's written a study advocating for a Green New Deal. The study is called A Green New Deal. Greg is with Data for Progress, which is a Washington-based group, and this is WMNF in Tampa. So, Greg, some of the jobs, though, if you're planting trees and reforesting, which I think a lot of people would think would be a good idea, those are not high-skilled jobs. Would you guarantee a minimum wage, or what would you say to those people whose job it would be to reforest?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it really depends on what kind of programs and how those are implemented. You mentioned the guarantee, right, and that's this idea about a job guarantee, which I think it's not a new idea, but I think it's fresh to the conversation about how do we guarantee for folks that are looking for a good job, who don't want to go from part-time job to part-time job, make a minimum wage, who want an alternative, almost a public option for a good job. And so we would need to define, I think, through a good job guarantee design would mean that it is a higher paying job, not higher paying, but it's, like I said, it's a livable wage, it's a family supporting wage, it's a job with dignity that fulfills some program. And whether that's working lands for on the restoration efforts or other community development efforts that are identified. There's some folks who have thought about what a program like that could look like. And one example might be it is operating through local nonprofits to find people who want to contribute to land restoration.
So what would be the most expensive part of this proposal, the way you looked at it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it really all depends on how you pursue a lot of the transformation, right? In terms of renewable energy, there's already markets for renewable energy, right? So you could spend a lot of money paying for, installation, or you put the incentives in place and remove some of the, fossil fuel subsidies, and then you kind of let the market just grow around that. If you had a really big jobs program, then that would be the most expensive, right? Because you're paying for a lot of labor and that. So we haven't really looked too much at the numbers on this, and that would take time because there is no real specific vision. There's no one unified vision of what this whole thing could be. But I think when you're talking about massive changes to built infrastructure, that's where the costs are going to come. You're talking about construction costs, you're talking about labor, and so anything related to transportation, urban planning, retrofitting of buildings, hardening communities to climate impact, I think that's where you're going to see a lot of the cost, but that's also where you're going to see a lot of the cost returns, right? Because you're reducing energy costs, you're increasing resilience so that you're not incurring as much damage to all of these severe weather events.
Well, we're talking about a Green New Deal, and this is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. A few years ago, President Obama had that Cash for Clunkers program, and what he did was he gave incentives to people for buying new cars that were more energy efficient. And then for years, we've had tax breaks for people that buy electric cars. Countries like Norway are trying to encourage all their people to switch to electric cars. China has a program to switch in some cities to electric taxis. Would you give a subsidy to buy an electric car?
I think it's one tool. I think that it is vitally important that we transform the fuel of how we move ourselves around. If you look at where U.S. emissions come from, one of the fastest growing and top three sources is transportation. So that's passenger vehicles filling up our tank with gas and driving from here to there. And we need to figure out ways to both reduce the number of trips that people take, making mass transit, public transit, and other mobility options readily accessible and affordable. And then anything that moves, we need to electrify. And so that means whether that's providing incentives to buy electric cars, to install charging infrastructure in your home, but then also helping communities build charging infrastructure so that people that go in and around their community or through, you know, on an interstate know that wherever they go, they can get the energy that they need. Just like anywhere you go, you can find a gas station. And people need to understand that they can get from A to B and never have to worry about their, you know, their battery.
So Speaker Pelosi has named our local congressperson here in Tampa as the chair of this new committee, the House Select Committee on Climate Crisis. The incoming congresswoman, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, had wanted to be on that committee. She wanted to be the chair of the committee. She was not named the chair. What do you think of the new committee that Speaker Pelosi has announced?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people view it as kind of a bittersweet, right, where there were a lot of demands on the committee resolution for a Green New Deal to make sure that it had subpoena power, to make sure that there was required people who didn't take money from the fossil fuel industry, that it had a mandate to create this. And none of those things came about. But I think that we have now a space at the national level to debate this that we didn't have 2 months ago. And I think that that's a really important win that we have to acknowledge. But I can understand those that feel, and I'm one of those, that we want to make sure that our response to this meets the scale and urgency of the problem. Like, climate change truly is the crisis, and a lot of communities feel that way. And folks were concerned if this committee did not meet that, and I think that's yet to be seen. We want to see how Congresswoman Castor leads that committee.
So, what would it cost? Do you have a universal number, a big number of all these ideas? What would it cost to implement these ideas? How much energy would we save, and how much carbon reduction would there be in the atmosphere?
Yeah, the cost question is really hard to answer, to pinpoint, right? Because as I said, there's a lot of mechanisms to get at, whether you're incentives or whether you're just paying for things, and whether you're doing a full job guarantee or not. But I think that you want to think about it in terms on the orders of, you know, $100 billion a year, kind of in that order of magnitude. You know, certainly not in the trillions. You know, the economy is measured in trillions, and so, but not in the low billions. We really have to view this in terms of the 100 or 200 billion kind of annual investment over some period of time to transform the economy. But as I said, the costs come back in the energy savings, in the impacts on the economy and built infrastructure on climate impacts. And also it comes back in terms of economic growth, right? We're supporting new industries that have yet to explode. Fossil fuel has been growing, has been the top industry in the world for as long as most of us can remember. And renewable energy will get there, and that will bring economic activity and technology that is American bred, and Americans can export that, and that's great. And then in terms of emission reductions, you know, we have a sense of where we need to be. We need to be, as a country, as close to zero, net zero emissions by the middle of the century. And we need to make a lot of progress on that over the next, you know, 10 years. To be on that trajectory in order to avoid some of the worst climate impacts that are predicted by, you know, the international scientists that study this best.
Mm. So no hard numbers in terms of energy savings or what about job creation? Any idea how many jobs you would create by spending these hundreds of millions of dollars?
I mean, there's some formulas out there depending on whether you're investing, you know, if you're investing in construction-related stuff. And, you know, looking at trying to, I think of more of it as what is the order of magnitude of change that we're trying to see in economic activity. And so the numbers that we put in the report is around like 10 million jobs over 10 years associated with this. And I've had other economists come to me and say that that's a lowball number. And so I'm still diving into that research. That's going to be, as I said, I'm looking into the green jobs question. And I really think it's important for folks to understand that their local communities, their districts, their states will see an economic benefit to this kind of investment. And that's in terms of job and activity, but also the environmental benefits. But, you know, think in terms of the tens of millions of jobs that can be supported by this kind of stuff.
Greg, besides Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and some of the new progressive members of the U.S. House, any other politicians, are they embracing this idea of a Green New Deal?
Yeah, I think quite a number are. I mean, as you mentioned, there's several members of the House that signaled their support for the select committee. I think it was on the order of 50, so that they agree on the sense of urgency and the scale of the response that we need. There's several folks who may or may not be running for president if they haven't come out yet, who have signaled that a Green New Deal or climate is going to be a top priority for them. That includes folks like Senator Booker, Senator Sanders, Jay Inslee, Elizabeth Warren has commented on it, Beto O'Rourke has commented on it. There's a lot of folks that we can't forget who have been working in the state and local in this space for years who understand what a Green New Deal could mean for them locally. So I think a lot more folks, as they understand what this is, will be vocal in their support. And all of that signals to me that this is going to be part of the conversation, certainly over the next 2 years as we figure out the next direction for this country and who's going to want to lead it in 2021.
And Greg, where would this put the U.S. in terms of trying to accomplish a carbon, you know, an economy that doesn't emit carbon neutral? Where would this put us? Would it, you know, compared to China, compared to some of the other large economies out there, you know, England and France and Japan? Where would it put us?
I mean, it would put us as number one. You know, countries came together over 3 years ago now for the Paris Agreement, and they put together, you know, their first international target about emission reductions, and that was in kind of the 2025 kind of target. You know, China's the top emitter, U.S. is number two, the EU is certainly up there, but they've peaked and they're going down, and there's other developed economies that still have a lot of emissions and don't have the full ambitious path to get to zero emissions by mid-century. And then you have other countries like India and Brazil who are creeping up, right? And so if the United States were to put a plan on paper to codify that we are going to go to zero emissions by mid-century, in terms of, you know, there's some other countries that have expressed that plan, but in terms of big economies, we'd be the best.
Well, Greg, we're down to the last minute. Is there anything else you want to add?
No, I mean, as you said, the listeners here are within the district of Representative Castor, and you know, I think we should find some inspiration in the words that she said as she spoke about the committee, and I think that she said it will be, you know, work in the spirit of a Green New Deal, but recognizing that the mechanics of it are very labor intensive. I think the vision of what this means will be different for different people. It'll affect communities at the federal, state, and local levels differently. And I think the goal right now is to agree on the goals and to give our everybody the time to work through the policy specifics and build the coalition so that we have the strongest likelihood of success on these programs.
And Greg, what's the best website where people can find your study, A Green New Deal?
Yeah, so you can go to dataforprogress.org/Green New Deal, but you can find it. Or you can find me on Twitter at Gregory T. Carlock, and you can find it through there.
All right, Greg Carlock, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Thanks, Greg. Greg is with a group called Data for Progress. He's the lead author on a study called A Green New Deal, and Greg spells his last name C-A-R-L-O-C-K. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. In a moment, we're going to look at whether or not the president has the constitutional power to take money from the Pentagon and put it towards building the wall.
I'm blessed with her devotion, Mother.
There's Tom Rush. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Well, with no end in sight to the government shutdown, President Trump's administration is reportedly laying the groundwork to declare a national emergency to access funds for his much-debated wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. Sources familiar with the preparations tell the Washington Post and CNN that Trump is eyeing billions of unspent dollars from the Defense Department's disaster recovery and military construction coffers to build the wall, a project for which Democrats have refused to approve funding and that Trump is unwilling to bend on. Some of the money that Trump wants to use may come from funds slated for disaster relief in Puerto Rico, Texas, California, Florida, and other regions devastated by hurricanes, fires, and other natural disasters. According to the official who spoke with CNN, the White House has asked the Pentagon to provide it with a list of funds that have been earmarked for relief projects but have not yet been spent. That's a sum totaling around $13 billion. Use of that unspent money for a national emergency is allowed by Title 10 of the U.S. Code. According to one of the sources who spoke with the Post, Trump has put pressure on the Army Corps of Engineers to give him a timeline for signing construction contracts and would like to begin work on the wall within the next 45 days. Though Trump has characterized undocumented immigration through the U.S.-Mexico border as a major security threat to the U.S., the data do not back up his claims. We're joined now by Louis Varelli. He's a professor of law at Stetson University College of Law in Gulfport. He teaches administrative law, civil procedure, constitutional law, and the separation of powers. He's the author of Disqualifying the High Court, Supreme Court Recusal, and the Constitution. Before joining the Stetson Law faculty, Professor Varelli served for 5 years as a trial attorney in the Civil Division of the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C. And Professor Varelli, welcome back to WMNF. Nice to have you here.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
All right. So, does the president have the power to do this?
Well, of course, that's the question, right? I mean, I think so. The way to answer that, and I don't want to answer that like the traditional law professor that says everything depends. the starting point is, does he have the ability to declare a national emergency? That's going to be the fulcrum around which all of this turns. And the short answer is yes. The National Emergencies Act, which was passed in 1976, gives the president the authority to declare a national emergency pretty much at his sole discretion. There are some checks on that power, but they're quite weak and have been made weaker over time. So the ability to declare a national emergency is relatively straightforward. The question then, and that's a significant issue that is important for the American public to understand, because the number of powers that then follow have been granted by Congress but are significant, and they've been pretty widely reported in the Atlantic and elsewhere. And that's really where this question will turn. Does President Trump have a congressionally delegated power, statutory power, that it can be triggered simply by him declaring a national emergency, as opposed to Congress appropriating funds or granting him the right to spend money directly on a border wall?
So there is no level of proof required that if the president says there's a national emergency, he doesn't have to prove it to anyone. He just says there's a national emergency?
That's the general understanding. So the statute just says that the president can declare a national emergency. Of course, there are going to be legal challenges to the sort of baseline question of whether this actually amounts to an emergency. There doesn't appear to be any data or evidence that what's happening at the southern border amounts to our sort of common understanding of what an emergency is, particularly because it's a relatively consistent phenomenon that's been going on for decades. But what I think, where I think the problem lies, is that the statute doesn't create a standard, and the courts have been historically reluctant to tell presidents or to check presidents' ability to declare emergencies for the sensible proposition, at least generally, that presidents can act more quickly than Congress, and when in fact an emergency exists, the president has to be able to recognize it and respond.
And do you know the background of why this law was passed? And again, remind us of what the name of this law is.
It's called the National Emergencies Act. It was passed in 1976, but it's sort of the culmination of a long history of presidential emergency powers. Abraham Lincoln was taken to task for suspending habeas corpus during the Civil War. President Roosevelt, of course, history has judged negatively, and rightfully so, for interning Japanese Americans during World War II based on his emergency powers that he derived from the Constitution and wartime. This act, I think, was meant to sort of formalize the process. This is what a national emergency looks like. These are the checks that can be put on it. The original statute permitted the two houses of Congress to terminate a national emergency without the president's signature. That has since been amended. That has since been amended to require the president's signature to terminate a national emergency, and that's one of the problems here. Congress is has very limited power to check the president once he has declared a national emergency, for the simple reason that they'd have to override his veto. So presumably, if Congress tried to stop the president from declaring a national emergency and the president didn't want to, he would veto that bill, that joint resolution. The only way for Congress then to put it into effect would be to override it with a two-thirds vote in both houses, and that's very difficult to do politically. So that's sort of the ongoing statutory problem with the National Emergencies Act, is that the ability of Congress to check the president is significantly limited.
We're talking with Louis Varelli. He's a professor of law at Stetson University College of Law in Gulfport, and this is WMNF in Tampa. You mentioned FDR and Lincoln. Have there been times, at modern times, where a president has invoked this emergency authority?
Yes. So there's been emergency authority invoked by our last two presidents, relating to the war in the Middle East. For President Bush and President Obama invoked his emergency powers in various places, too. I mean, I think the general consensus, and the reason we weren't talking about those activities in the same way, is that they were not as they did not represent as broad a reading of the emergency power as this would. I mean, I think the general consensus is that this was not thought of, the situation at the southern border was not thought of as an emergency prior to President Trump characterizing it as such. That doesn't mean he doesn't have the legal authority to declare the national emergency, but it is counterintuitive, I think, to many in the American public, that this rises to the level of an emergency and therefore requires extraordinary presidential action.
All right, so let me go to the other side of this, and that what President Trump is apparently wanting to do, and this is according to CNN this morning in the Washington Post, is that he wants to take funds slated for disaster relief for Florida, Puerto Rico, Texas, California, after the hurricanes and fires, all the stuff that we've been experiencing. And then this is in the Pentagon budget that's been authorized by Congress. He wants to take some of that money that's not been spent yet for the disasters, and we know that there is an ongoing disaster right there in the Florida panhandle. Recovery is not complete, but he wants to take that money that's in that budget, about $13 billion, and then apply it towards building the wall, and he wants to put the Army Corps of Engineers in charge of building it and begin work in the next 45 days. Does that scenario raise any questions for you?
It does, and it does for several reasons. I mean, sort of, I think the most important thing for our listeners here is we are entitled to judge our leaders both on law and policy. So whether the president ultimately prevails in a legal challenge, and there will be lots of lawsuits, and I'll talk about where they will come from in a second, we are expected to judge our leaders' decisions based on whether we think they're a good idea. So whether the president can deviate those funds or not, the fact that he might choose to do so is something that we are entitled to and required to hold him accountable for in elections. And that's why when I talk about all of the presidents that I've spoken about as an academic to the public, I always remind them that the vote is the most powerful tool we all have to influence their choices. As to the legality of what President Trump is planning on doing, the National Emergencies Act does require that he articulate which is the source of the authority he is using once he declares a national emergency. So he's going to have to point to a statute that he claims allows him to spend this money based on the fact that it's a national emergency to build a border wall. The statute that I've seen most frequently cited is in Title 10 of the U.S. Code, as you said, it's Section 2808, and it's about spending funds for military construction. Now, that section of the United States Code, that law, has a couple of conditions, right? One is that the national emergency has to require the use of the armed forces. Generally speaking, immigration questions are not the province of the armed forces, and there are lots of reasons for that that we can talk about. But there's a very long history in America of the law prohibiting the military from being allowed to engage in law enforcement, what we can think of as police activities domestically. So it has to require the use of the armed forces. It has to be military construction. Right? That doesn't mean construction by the military. That means construction for the military, or at least I think that's the best reading of the statute. And the spending of funds or the construction has to be necessary to support the use of the armed forces. So the most common reading of that are things like building airfields. right? If we need an air base someplace to support our military in a foreign country or even domestically, the president can declare an emergency and use those funds to build that airfield so that the armed forces can use them. I don't think it's hard to understand how far a cry that is from a border wall. And so those, if the president articulates that that is the statute he's going to be relying on if and when he declares a national emergency, there are going to be some direct challenges to whether his use of these funds qualify under that statute, and that's something the courts are going to have to decide. That is a much more traditional legal question. So that is a question that courts are much more likely to be comfortable deciding than, for example, whether there's actually a national emergency that the statute doesn't define and that the president is allowed to declare.
And who would be in a position to file a lawsuit? Which parts of our government or which parts of the public would be able to file a lawsuit in this case?
That's a very good question, right? It's, of course, going to depend on how the challenge arises. We can assume that the Department of Defense will not bring a suit to protect its own funds because the Secretary of Defense works for the president. For example, landowners on the border who might have a wall built will be able to claim injury by the building of that wall, and as a defense against the building of the wall, ask the courts to enjoin the president from using military funds to build that wall because it violates the statute and it will harm them by putting a border wall either on their property or in the vicinity of their property. There's also going to be the problem of the president having to take private lands to build the wall. And there's no question that he'll have to do that. And eminent domain was what we call the taking of private lands by the government. That is not something that's prohibited necessarily, but it has to be done for public use, and it is often the source of legal challenges. So we're going to have another set of legal challenges based on the acquisition of land, and there is currently an environmental lawsuit filed because the Secretary of Homeland Security has provided a waiver against normal environmental regulations that would accompany a building project of this size, sort of environmental impact questions. And whether that waiver is valid is being challenged in the courts. So there's going to be a litany of legal challenges brought on several levels. The likelihood is that they will definitely not solely target the declaration of national emergency per se. So that is going to be the hardest thing to challenge because of the wording of the statute. But all of the choices the president makes once that emergency has been declared are going to be the subject of lawsuits and could tie this up for a long time. And that's important because it is a political choice and the politics of this may very well change.
Our guest is Louis Borelli, a professor of law at Stetson University College of Law, and this is WMNF in Tampa. So what about the citizens of Mexico Beach or Panama Beach saying, hey, there's disaster relief money for us, you're going to take it to build the wall? Or what about the state of Florida saying, hey, we need that money to recover from the disaster, or the state of California? Or what about the Congress? Could they say, at least the House of Representatives might say, look, we passed a bill putting disaster relief into the Pentagon budget, but we didn't intend it to build a wall. Could Congress say we authorized money, but not for this particular purpose?
So that's an issue that comes up frequently in questions about the legality of government action. It's a legal term we call standing, right? So in order to bring a case in a federal court, you have to be able to prove that you are the correct plaintiff. In other words, you are the one who's been injured and who is asking the court to help you. So citizens of the Gulf Coast in Florida who can demonstrate or can allege with good faith that they're having funds taken from their relief efforts to their detriment may very well have standing. The state of Florida may very well have standing. That's the kind of question the courts are going to have to decide once a complaint is filed, because the determination of standing depends on what the lawsuit alleges, specifically what the lawsuit alleges. Does the lawsuit allege adequate harm? I have not heard, and I am not of the opinion that standing will be a prohibitive problem for people seeking to challenge any action taken by the president to build a border wall. I think there is a list of viable plaintiffs out there, and they will be able to bring suit. The question then will be, how are the courts going to interpret whatever statutory authority the president relies on, and are they going to be comfortable telling a president you can't pursue what you determine to be a national emergency? This is the kind of case that I think brings that question, to the difficulties of that question, most clearly into light. In other words, this is a case that's pretty close to the edge of a national emergency, such that I think the courts are going to be more likely to take up this than they would, say, for example, something based on an overseas incident or some sort of terrorism justification for declaring a national emergency.
Yeah, have we ever had a case like this in modern times where either the people or a government body challenges the president's use of money in during a time that he declares an emergency?
I can't think of a situation on the top of my head where there's been a financial challenge. When President Lincoln suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War, there was a challenge to his ability to do that. And he admitted in his speech that he thought it was a questionable constitutional decision. Of course, there was a challenge to the Japanese internment decision by President Roosevelt that unfortunately and inappropriately the internees, the detainees, lost. But generally speaking, these emergency powers are invoked in and around conflict, armed conflict, sometimes, occasionally they've been invoked with respect to sort of financial crisis. But this would be, I can't prove that it's unique in the purest sense, that it's the only time it's ever happened, but it's certainly highly unusual for a president to take basically a political failing or a political loss, right, his inability to get the Congress to fund a border wall, and to then try to achieve that policy goal by declaring a national emergency. This is a pretty transparent attempt at doing that. And whether folks think the wall is a good idea or not, which is not the point of my comments, it does matter how these things are done. And the Congress of the United States, at least one house of which is still majority Republican, is not interested in funding this border wall, at least so it would seem. So the president declaring a national emergency to try to achieve that goal some other way is something we should all be watching very carefully.
And getting back to a point you made earlier, why do we not allow U.S. military forces to operate as law enforcement or operate domestically? Historically, why do we not allow that to happen?
Well, I think that's sort of the standard concern about autocracy, right? So autocrats historically use the military to retain control once they step outside of legitimate democratic processes. So I think we are historically concerned about the president, who is commander in chief under Article 2 of the Constitution. So the Constitution clearly assigns the commander in chief role to the president. If we allowed the president to then use the military in his commander in chief capacity domestically, so in lieu of the FBI, for example, or in lieu of state law enforcement, then you would have a consolidation of power that I think Americans have long been uncomfortable with, and I think rightfully so. And that's the sort of the specter of all this. I don't want to be too dramatic or alarmist, and I don't think we're there yet for sure. But it is fair to say, if national emergencies become something that the American people are desensitized to, we have to be honest about the scope of presidential power that can accompany them. Now, granted, it's all been granted by Congress, but it's been granted some time ago. In 1934, Congress allowed the president to shut down communications facilities in connection with his national emergency power. Now, in 1934, that meant telephones and telegraphs. Now it could mean the internet. So, again, we're not there yet. I'm not trying to raise an undue alarm, but using the national emergency power, particularly when it comes with the scope of authority that it currently does, is something we all should be aware of and careful about.
Now, the president has made two appointments to the U.S. Supreme Court. Ruth Bader Ginsburg apparently is in poor health. There is a conservative majority, I think it's fair to say. I don't know if you would agree, but on the Supreme Court. For those people that might be cynical, looking at the Supreme Court, thinking that it's not going to stand up to President Trump, what do you say?
Well, first, I would say that the Supreme Court is not the first or second court to hear this. So, in lots of the situations we've seen with President Trump, where his choices have been unusual or have not had a long historical pedigree, to say the least. For example, some of his immigration law choices prior to this, the travel ban, for example. The lower courts were pretty unified in stopping him from proceeding. It took three attempts at the travel ban for President Trump to succeed in pursuing his policy. And I think that is an example of the courts doing their job and sort of holding their ground. So there's going to be at least two levels of court. There's going to be the federal trial court level and the intermediate appellate court level that are going to have an opportunity to decide these cases. If they don't disagree with one another. So if the lower courts are relatively uniform, we may find that the Supreme Court doesn't weigh in, because historically they wouldn't if the lower courts are in agreement about something. Now, if this is an important enough issue that they feel like they need to weigh in, I think the Supreme Court, and I certainly hope that the Supreme Court takes seriously its role as a check on both of the other branches of government. And I don't have any reason to believe that the court will abandon that role. Now, of course, a conservative majority may be more inclined to support presidential authority, and that is something that some of the justices that we're talking about have a track record of doing or have been described as doing. But I think we're a far cry from that, and I think the Supreme Court, their independence is their defense that allows them to act as a check when they think the president has gone too far afield.
We're talking with Louis Borelli, who's a professor of law at Stetson University College of Law, and just repeating the headline in this this half hour: with no end in sight to the government shutdown, President Trump's administration is reportedly laying the groundwork to declare a national emergency to access funds for his much-debated wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. Some of those funds may come from disaster relief funds passed by Congress to help people in places like Florida, Puerto Rico, Texas, California recover from fires and hurricanes. So what are you going to watch for next? We're not there yet. The president hasn't declared a national emergency. We're in the area of speculation, and thank you for doing it, because, you know, we don't like to speculate too much, but what are you going to watch for next?
I'm going to be very closely watching Congress, and the reason I say that is because if this is both inextricably tied to the shutdown and totally inopposite, to use a legal term, to the shutdown. So in other words, the border wall has nothing necessarily to do with the government shutdown. The government could reopen with or without a border wall, and it would not answer the border wall question in any meaningful way. So the president could pursue this policy outside of the government shutdown. So it's going to be interesting to see if the Congress decides that it is no longer interested in even considering the connection between the two and creates a veto-proof majority to reopen the government, or at least to reopen parts of it. So if Congress were to present a bill to the president to reopen the government that did not include the wall, they are entitled to do that. Senate Majority Leader McConnell has said he will not present any bill to the president that the president doesn't support, but that could change if the politics of this changed. If they present a bill to reopen the government and the president vetoes it, Congress can override it by a two-thirds vote in both houses, and then the government is open whether the president likes it or not. That's politically unlikely, but not impossible. So I'll be watching to see how close Congress gets, or how agitated Congress gets, frankly, with the role that the border wall is playing in a government shutdown, because it's important to remember they are not connected unless the president wants them to be. Congress does not want them to be.
Yeah. Professor Borelli, what's the best article you've read on the topic in the last 24 hours?
There's an article in The Atlantic, and I'm going to mispronounce her name, by Elizabeth Guetian, I believe is how you pronounce it. Her last name is spelled, it's Guetian, G-O-I-T-I-E-N. She's from the Brennan Center for Justice. It's in The Atlantic, and it's a great account of sort of how the National Emergency Act works and the role of national emergencies in our government.
Well, Professor Borelli, thanks for your constitutional expertise. Great to have you on WMNF.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. That's Professor Louis Borelli. He's a professor of law at Stetson University College of Law in Gulfport. And among his areas of expertise, constitutional law. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. And we'll play those comments back on Monday at 11 o'clock, and we'll find out whether or not the president does declare a national emergency and take the money that's already been appropriated for other things and give them to the construction of a border wall. Stay tuned. Janelle Irwin is coming up next right here on WMNF in Tampa. Thanks to Patty Perkey and Frank Knox for being our phone producers today. I'm Rob Lori. Hope you have a great weekend. This is WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg. Here's the latest news from NPR.